good morning, everybody, and welcome to Polar Connect with Paula Dell and the research team that's studying the biology of Antarctic fishes. It is Friday, the 27th of May, 2011, and my name is Kristen Tim, and I'm here at Arcus in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm here with Rhea, and we're going to talk to Paula in just a little bit here, but I'm going to show you a couple slides first to tell you a little bit about the platform that we're using today and why Paula is out in the field. So if you're not familiar with the Horizon Wimba platform, you should have just seen your slide change in the middle of the screen there. If you're using VoiceOver IP to talk today, there's a talk button in the lower left-hand corner. And when you want to ask a question, you'll need to press and hold the talk button the entire time that you're trying to talk. Just below the talk button, there's a chat box. You can use that feature to chat to the whole conference, or you can use the pull-down menu on the left to select one participant to chat to. The chat is only accessible to those that are actually watching Wimba. So because of her kind of slower internet connection at the station, Paula cannot see the chat today. So any questions that come up over the chat, I'll make sure to relay to her whenever we get a chance. If you go towards the right-hand side of the platform, there's a list of all the participants online. Right underneath that list of participants, there's a hand button, and you can press the hand button to get in line to ask a question. And after you've asked your question, you can press the hand button again, and your number will go away from your name. If you're having any problems today, sometimes it helps exit or go back to the lobby and then come back into the room, and usually that'll help solve the problem. So that exit and lobby button are on the right-hand side over there. So before we get started, I'm just going to do a quick roll call to see who's online and so that Paula can hear who's online. So when your name is called from my list here, please say your name, say where you are, and if there's any students with you today, let me know the number of students that are participating. So quickly, John Meyer, Malala Elementary School, Kathleen Dell, Northwestern University. Stephen Bowl. Kevin Bolt, Caneland Harder Middle School.
This is Mr. Welch.
Okay, I heard you guys. You're kind of coming through muffled again, so if you want, feel free to type in the chat box the number of students that are with you there today. Rita Nelson, Loyola University. William Morrell, Lindblom.
We're here, and we have about 70 students.
Okay, great. Andy Fitz, Lindblom.
Andy's here with me also, with William.
Oh, okay. And Charles Billadue, Loyola University, Chicago. Kevin Quirk. Megan Horsch, Mokena Intermediate.
I'm here with 26 students.
Okay, great. Welcome. Eileen Kelly. Mark Goldner.
Here with 16 students.
Okay. Welcome, you guys. Alex Eiler, Pink Palace Museum. Lou Ellen Finn, Northwestern University. Scott Mackin.
We're here, Merrill, Wisconsin.
Two friends.
okay, Penny Dell? Kieran Cahill? Phoenicia Elementary? Betsy Wilkening?
I'm here in Tucson with one high school student. We're on vacation now, so.
All right. Hey,
yay for that one person.
Good to hear you, Betsy. Okay. So, was there anybody on the list that I didn't call besides Mark's students? I'm not going to go through and find out who all of you are. Any other schools online? Okay, so moving on then, just briefly, what is Polar Trek? So Paula is a participant in the Polar Trek program, and that's why she's in Antarctica right now. And Polar Trek is a professional development program for K-12 teachers where they're paired with researchers for 2 to 6 or sometimes longer research experiences in the polar regions. And from 2010 to 2013, nearly 50 teachers from around the United States will join scientists in the Arctic and Antarctic to learn more about science in the polar regions and share what they've learned with their students and their communities through events like this. So we're happy to be talking with Paula and the team today. If we have questions as we go along, you can raise your hand button. You can type your question in the chat box. And at the end of the call, hopefully we'll have some time that you can actually come online and ask your questions live to Paula and the research team. So with that, I have your first slide up, Paula, so I'm going to turn it over to you.
Okay. I briefly saw you guys, and then it disappeared. We're still working on this, but... Well, good. Welcome. This is exciting. I wish I could, like, talk to each of you individually, but... for teachers out there who don't know, you should definitely apply to this. And come down here. This is the most amazing place. Oh, you keep popping up. Anyway, so this first, I don't know, maybe you can see me on there. So I actually should add Arcus to this first slide as well, but which who administer Polar Trek, right? And while this picture doesn't really do it justice, these fish are really beautiful, prehistoric, and sort of awe-inspiring when you see them. So let's start. The first, you can go to the next slide, which is like it allow us to introduce ourselves. That's Kristen on the left, myself, and Lisa on the end. Getting suited up to go fishing, which here we are donned in our fishing gear as we head out to haul in the catch in our dashing outfits. There's really all kinds of gear to deal with down here because the weather can be quite unforgiving if you're not prepared. Oh, I see the slides. Kristen and Lisa are actually taking some tissues of some fish right now, so they'll be up probably in about 10 or 15 minutes to join us. Okay, next slide. Just to give you a sense, and especially for the students out there, of where we are, we are on the western side of the peninsula in Antarctica, which is directly south of South America. Is that second slide up? Okay. So if you look in the upper right-hand corner, it's South America, and there's Antarctica, home of the ice fishes, and we are on the western side of that peninsula up there. I'm staying at Palmer Station, and we're doing our fishing in those areas down through there. We boarded on the research vessel, Lawrence M. Gould, up in Punta Arenas in Chile, and it's not an easy place to get to. It took us 5 days coming down on the ship, and those waters can be pretty rough. But this is where the ice fish live, down here in the Southern Ocean, and which is around the continent. So our first job was to catch some fish so we could study. Next slide. There are two primary ways that we catch the fish that we need. The main way that we catch the ice fish, who tend to be benthic, which means they live on the bottom, is through trawling. So here's a picture from the deck. A trawl is that really large net you see in the middle there, sprawled across the deck. And we drop it down about 150 to 200 meters, which is about 500 to 600 feet or so. And it literally just drags along the bottom and catches everything in its way, and we bring it up. I actually have some video of trawling in my journals online at polartrek.com. May 23rd, I have some video and a description of it on May 12th. It's really fast-paced, as you might think, because what you want to do is get those fish out of that net and back into the water as quickly as possible. And they come up with all kinds of animals in there. It's really crowded, and it's pretty stressful for the fish. So you want to be very quick. And I put some inserts in there to kind of give you a sense of how fast-paced it is. You want to grab the fish, put them in the fish buckets, and take them to the aquarium. So next slide, please. So the other way that we catch the fish is through fish pots, which you can see them there on the deck, which are big wire, like wire pots that are, this is how we catch the red-blooded fish. They're more active. They tend to come in. They sort of check in, but they can't check out. There's bait in the middle of these, and they go in, but they're structured as such that when the fish go in, they're blocked from leaving. So we put them, we drop them down in various spots, and they have those big orange buoys attached and some lights. And of course, we take the coordinates. We drop those pots down. The fish come in, and then about, you know, 8 to 12 hours later, we go back and haul them up. So the picture in the upper right or left-hand corner, we're taking some fish out, and all of these require a lot of work on the part of the marine techs on the boat, because they're literally standing there on the side of the boat with no barrier. So they're hooked in with straps, and they make it look easy, but it's pretty treacherous work, especially we had a few days that were really wavy and not such great weather, windy. Okay, next. So this next slide, I think, is like probably one of the more interesting ones, in that we pull up all kinds of invertebrates in this trawl, because it literally is just coming across the bottom. It scoops up everything in the path. So we actually, it's a real treat to see all this stuff. Invertebrates, meaning they have no backbone. So the picture in the middle is you can see what the trawl looks like when it comes up. You can see all that stuff in that net. And then there's four black pots next to it, sort of big tubs full of water. So we pull the fish, pull the fish out of that trawl, put them in those tubs as quickly as we can, and then we take them into the aquarium. Again, on the journals, there's some pictures of all this, of fish pots. Gosh, I have some videos of the fish pot early on also, so you might want to check that. So if you want to quickly go through in the upper left-hand corner, that would be a sea cucumber. Then you see a ray, a little small stingray. Chitin is that third picture where I'm holding it. Amphipod, which is a really large one. A lot of them are small. Then you see a sea star, a little baby octopus, another sea star held by yours truly. Very cool to look at these things. There's a polychaete that looks a little bit like a hairy caterpillar. The next one is really beautiful. Those crinoids are really amazing. And then an anemone, which is sort of inverted and upside down. You can't really tell. And then an octopus, which is a little harder to see, but it was quite big. So these are all kinds of things that we pull up, which are really great to look at. And then we throw them back in. We keep the fish, and everybody else goes back in. There's not a whole lot of other types of fish. There's some smaller ones, but we'll get into that in a bit. So next slide. So moving on to our study of the ice fish. So we all have hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is what makes our blood red. And it's a protein in our blood that binds to the oxygen. And it carries oxygen in our blood so we can carry a lot of it, even if we're not using it. We all have it, and all vertebrates actually have hemoglobin, except the one fish family, Canichaeae, which are the ice fish. And these are the only known vertebrates that do not have hemoglobin. So that means their organs, their blood, all of these things that you associate with the color of blood are not red. We can go into questions on that. So this diagram kind of shows you. The oxygen binds to the hemoglobin. It carries it through your body. Then it takes it to your cells and releases it in your cells, where your cells use it to break down your food so you get energy. So ice fish have no hemoglobin. So let's move on to the next.
Hey, Paula, there was a couple of questions that came up in the chat really quickly.
Okay.
I don't know, you can decide if you want to take them now or later, but is it an actual aquarium, or is that just what you call, or is it just a nickname for something you put the fish in? And then there's a couple questions here about the fish that you've caught.
Oh yeah, I see these here. Yeah, well, it is sort of an actual aquarium. We have six big tanks that we put the fish in. So we separate them by species. So we put the ice fish. There's other Antarctic fish that we're also studying, red-blooded fish. So we separate them. And again, if you look at my journals, I have some pictures of these aquariums more recently. I think the 23rd of May. The fish really vary, but the ice fish are quite large. They can get up to 2 feet or more. Some of the other fish, I would say, are about 8 to 12 inches, a little bigger. These fish are only found in the Southern Ocean, in Antarctica. And why they don't have hemoglobin, I see as a question. We're going to get to that. The fish, none of that, we don't end up throwing any of them back. We do harvest their tissues to study, but none of the fish goes to waste. We look at their liver, their heart, their blood, their muscles, all of this stuff to see what's going on. But we'll get to that. So why don't we go to the next slide? Yes, blood with hemoglobin on the left, and the one on the right is what ice fish blood looks like. It's clear. It's kind of cloudy. So it's pretty amazing when you first see it. And when you look, I have some pictures of their, if you go to the next slide, you can look at their gills and liver. The gills, the liver, the heart, they're all white. So if you compare them to the gills of the ice fish, of the red blood, compare the gills of the ice fish to the red-blooded fish, those gills and liver, I took those pictures yesterday. But again, they don't have red blood cells. And it's pretty striking if you look at the difference in that liver, especially. I'm sure you've never seen a liver look like that before. So what does this mean for the ice fish, that they have no hemoglobin? We can go to the next slide. So we all need oxygen. Ice fish need oxygen. We need oxygen, all living, all aerobic organisms. As I said, oxygen is transported into our cells, and there's this little organelle, meaning a little organ within a cell. It's part of a cell. I don't know how many of you have gotten this far in biology. But there's a little part of a cell called a mitochondria. And that takes the oxygen to convert our food into energy. And the chemical reaction between the food we eat and the oxygen transforms into ATP, which is the form of energy our bodies use. And the primary waste product that our cells get rid of is carbon dioxide, which you may or may not know, we exhale that. So we inhale the oxygen, travels through our blood into our cells. The mitochondria is sort of analogous to a little power generator in your cell. It's churning out the energy. So we need oxygen. If you want to go to the next slide. So we need oxygen, and the hemoglobin carries that oxygen in our blood. But the ice fish, the Oceratus, if you see the sea Oceratus, and the Coreoceps. These are the two primary types of fish that we're studying. The Oceratus is a white-blooded ice fish. The Coreoceps is a red-blooded fish in the Antarctic waters. But they can't carry very much oxygen in their blood. The Coreoceps, if you look at it, can store a whole bunch more because it has hemoglobin. It can sort of like a little storage unit in their blood. So go to the next slide. Now there's differences in the water. And cold water has a whole lot of dissolved oxygen that is immediately available for the fish to use. So cold water is a great environment for an animal that can't carry or store much oxygen in its blood. It's sort of like being at an all-you-can-eat buffet. They can go in, they have all this oxygen available, and it's there. There's no need to store it up. But if you look at the graph, you might say, so what do you see happening when, if you look down along the bottom and the temperature starts heating up, you can look at what happens to the amount of oxygen that's available. So what you see happening, the warmer the water, the lower the amount of dissolved oxygen. There's not as much oxygen available, and that's not so good if you don't have hemoglobin, if you don't have a way to sort of store it up. So the ice fishes have evolved in a much different environment. They've evolved in this very cold environment. I'll go to the next slide, please. In fact, their evolution has been a pretty unique set of conditions. The waters, like I said before, are surround Antarctica. The Southern Ocean is just consistently really cold, minus 0.8. to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which by us is like 28 to 35 degrees. And maybe you can think, we could talk about this in the question and answer period, is if it's 32 degrees, why isn't it frozen? It's a little something to think about. Okay, next. In addition to these really cold waters, the ice fish have evolved in the question of competition. So here's a picture that shows you there was this mixed diversity. About 34 to 56 million years ago, you had all kinds of organisms and species because it was different. As you know, the world has changed and climate has changed dramatically. And over time, as this area down here became really cold, and the climate's changed, continents, you can, next slide, please. Today, the ice fish really dominate. What you see in terms of fish down here, the notostenioids, which are the Antarctic fish, which are red and white-blooded, are the predominant vertebrate organism. These other species are either not here anymore or very low, very few. So there isn't much of bird life. Next slide, please.
Paula, there was kind of a related question that came up to this earlier in the chat. Do ice fish only live in Antarctica then?
Yes, they do. They're only found here. 10 minutes? Sorry. Yeah, they're only found here.
Okay.
The Antarctic fish, yeah, good question. Okay, yeah, so the next slide, if you look at the other benthic fishes, which that are in the Antarctic region, remember benthic means living on the bottom, the notostenioidei down there, which are the Antarctic fish, account for 101 out of the 222 species and almost half of the biomass. So they, you know, they rule down here. It's like half of the fauna in the waters down here in the bottom are these fish. That's pretty substantial. All right, next slide. So those are the conditions they've evolved in. You have these very cold waters, and you have minimal competition. So I suspect by this point you must be saying, okay, so what does hemoglobin have to do with all this? How did this come about? And if that's what you're thinking, that's a great question. Let's go to the next slide. Their lack of hemoglobin is actually believed to be sort of a random mutation that occurred about 2 to 5 million years ago. So if you remember your biology, or if you're about to learn it, mutations are not always bad. Some are deadly, and our organism cannot survive or pass it on to their offspring. Some are very advantageous, and some mutations have allowed species to really flourish in certain areas. And then some really don't matter one way or another. We have mutations happening in our genes that sort of are neither here nor there. And that's kind of what they think about with this, that they have this mutation. They stop producing this protein, hemoglobin, but because there was less competition, and the water was really cold, and they had lots of oxygen, it didn't really affect the species. They could continue. There's 16 species of these ice fish. These four here that are shown, the Esox, Georgianus, Oceratus, and Rastrospinosus, those are the main ones we've seen. I'm going to post a video. It's really cute. With the Georgianus, we call her Greta Garbo. They're really curious. They keep coming up and peeking at the camera when we take pictures of them, batting their eyes. Maybe not really, but it looks like it. Okay, so it was this random mutation that didn't hurt or help, and they just continued to survive. So the next slide. This next slide looks kind of scary and technical and difficult, and so don't freak out about it, because if you look at it, really all you want to do is look at the two genes. So the top one is a picture of the gene of the cordyceps, the one with the red-blooded, that has hemoglobin. Definition for hemoglobin is Hb plus Hb. And you see I circled those two parts where the part of the gene that says, okay, hemoglobin turned on. And then the bottom gene, it is a typical ice fish. And if you just look at the difference, the size, that big gray area that's sort of the coding part that tells it to work, and even the hemoglobin. There's only one little red part there as opposed to the three in the two spots. It's kind of like, you know, Mother Nature got a hold of some big scissors and whack, just cut it, and you have just a small fragment. So that's all I want you to see is this big difference in the gene. So that little gene on the bottom can no longer make hemoglobin. It doesn't have the instructions anymore. They're gone. And next slide. So without hemoglobin, even though the fish could survive okay, it needed to make some adjustments, some adaptations to accommodate for this. So what you find is really interesting, that they have about four times the amount of blood that a red-blooded fish would have of the same size. So say you take two fish the same size, the red-blooded, the white-blooded. The one without hemoglobin has about four times the amount of blood. Their hearts, you know, those pumps that send out the blood throughout your body, is about three times bigger. Those hearts are very spongy, so you have a lot of surface area, more room for that oxygen to cross into the cells. And the blood vessels are about twice as big. You can think about it like bigger pipes in the body. So in some parts of the body, there's twice as many blood vessels. And I guess, to summarize, the apparatus that involves carrying oxygen have evolved to circulate a lot more quickly. Hopefully that makes sense there. Next slide. Here's some examples I wanted to show you. So the two pictures on the top are white-blooded ice fish. The two pictures on the bottom are red-blooded. A on the top, the Oceratus again, is the one we're studying. These are blood vessels. I don't know if any of you guys went to Body Worlds when they came through, but it's very similar. Some dye, some latex was injected into the capillaries, and capillaries are little tiny blood vessels. So you just see this massive amount of capillaries, tons of little vessels carrying blood all through there. And then if you look at the lower right, the choriocepts, how much fewer? Like, just compare those two pictures and the difference in the number of blood vessels. This is just their eye. This is an example of how they've adapted to needing to get lots of oxygen through their bodies. Next slide. Here's a picture of their heart. This entire mass is the heart, even though on the left it looks like some gooey blob. That is that clearish gel-like structure on the right of the osteotomy, which is the picture on the left. That's the atria, where the blood comes in from the body. Then the mass, sort of the tannish-colored mass in the middle, is the ventricle. And then the white thing at the top is the bulbous arteriosus, which is another way of saying that's where so the blood comes in, goes in the atria, the ventricle, and then it comes up through that little bulbous. The blood pressure is sort of reduced before it goes back out into the gills, so it comes through. And then compare it to the heart of the choriocepts. I mean, these are two animals that are pretty much the same size, and that's a pretty distinctive difference. Those hearts, I see a question there. I would say our ice fish hearts, maybe an inch and a half. They're not real big. Next slide. So, the West Antarctic Peninsula, where does this fit into our research at large, is one of the most rapidly warming regions on Earth. Since 1951, the air temperatures have risen about 3 degrees Celsius. Sea surface temperature has gone up about 1 degree Celsius, and the effects are being seen. A good example are the penguin population down here and invertebrates. There's actually a very interesting recent article in the New York Times on May 10th, which I would encourage everybody to go take a look at, that talked about the warming down here in this exact region where I am and the toll that it's taking on the Adelie and the emperor penguins. So their phytoplankton and krill population is being affected, which these penguins would feed on. So as a result, you have fewer of those and a lot more Gentoo penguins who are just flourishing. It's a very interesting article I encourage you to look at. So all these things are happening. So our research down here, which a lot of research down here, is related exactly to this, to the warming conditions that are happening. So the question that we're looking at is, does the thermal tolerance differ between the red and the white-blooded Antarctic fish, those with no hemoglobin and those with hemoglobin? Can they both tolerate these rising temperatures the same, or do red-blooded fish have an advantage? So, next slide.
And there's a couple of quick questions that came up here related to your previous slide. If it's a white-blooded fish, why is the heart of the ice fish tan?
Yeah, because there is no hemoglobin. Like the regular, normally a heart is red. It's much redder. So, and these changes down here, yes, is believed to be because of global warming. So, let's see. Okay, so our question is, are ice fish more sensitive to the elevation and temperature? And it is, as it is, so supply and demand, it's pretty much equal. But, you go to the next slide, if the temperature goes up and things get warmer, what happens in the water is oxygen supply, go to the next one, decreases, but the demand for oxygen increases. So can they deal with that? How do these two fish deal with that differently? All right, next slide, please. So the upper limits, the higher of upper limits of temperature that ice fish can tolerate might be much lower than what the red-blooded fish can deal with. Because, as we talked about earlier, the red-blooded fish can take that oxygen and store it up. It's sort of like, I don't know if any of you have been to, gone and traveled somewhere with high elevation, where you go really high and you might feel short of breath. Now, our body's response is to pump out more red blood cells so we can grab more oxygen from the atmosphere. But these fish can't do that. They have to use the oxygen that's available to them. So will this decrease of oxygen in a warmer climate assist them? Next slide, please. The term for that limit is called the critical thermal maxima, CT max, and I just wanted to show you. This is sort of the apparatus, and this is kind of, these are kind of the aquarium tanks I was talking about, those blue things on the right. So we have fish tanks, and you can see the apparatus is hooked up. We have two tanks. They're both heated at the same degree. They're heated up consistently, except one has an oxygen generator. They're both being slowly heated. One tank will have oxygen being pumped in so that the available oxygen will remain more or less constant. So I should note, last season the team established that the ice fish can tolerate temperature increase. They cannot tolerate the temperature increase the same way as the red-blooded fish. They are more susceptible to higher temperatures, but this experimental design allows us to rule out the factor of oxygen, because as good scientists, you always want to rule out all the variables or narrow it down to one variable. So what we're doing this season is looking at, if the temperature still goes up and you have enough oxygen, can they tolerate this better? Because if they can, then we'll know it's a question of oxygen. If they can't, we'll know it's a question of heat. Next slide. So the experimental design is, we have two tanks, normal oxygen levels, high oxygen levels in tank. Next slide, you add heat. Kind of looks like a little fish fry, I know, but we can start adding the heat. The next slide. And then you wait to see when the fish can no longer what's called right itself, which is stay upright, and you record that temperature and the oxygen level. That process is not necessarily lethal. We did take fish out after they kind of tipped over, and you can put them back in the cold waters, and they eventually revive. Takes a little while sometimes. It's almost like a little fish coma or something, but they can revive. So we're just looking at that temperature and the oxygen level at that point that this happens. Now,
there were a couple of questions earlier, Paula, about the experiment itself. How many fish do you catch and how many do you use for the experiment?
Oh, gosh. We have, I would say we have about 100 fish. We've caught, I would say, around 100 fish. We use all of them. We pretty much, you know, you wanna have a big sample size. You wanna look. So we would have 60 or 70 ice fish and similar amount of the red-blooded fish. And we compare them, and we take all their tissues, and the team is going to go back to their labs in Alaska and Ohio and research all this and look at what they found. So pretty much the last, we have a couple more slides, and then we'll have some questions. The next slide, so if our hypothesis is correct, that the decrease in oxygen in the warmer waters is critical, an ice fish will be able to tolerate warmer waters if they have enough oxygen available. So with greater amounts of oxygen, the ice fish will be able to tolerate the higher temperatures. That's what we're looking at. You might want to think, what do you think will happen? Unfortunately, I can't tell you right now because that's exactly what we're studying, so you're going to have to stay tuned to find out. So next slide, I wanted to acknowledge the amazing science support from the ship, the Lawrence Gould, and at Palmer Station. And also the collaborators, the late Bruce Seidel, Jody Beers, Jeff Grimm, Marina Mueller. There's our team right there as a picture. It's Irina, Devin, Kristen, Lisa, myself. Polartrek, National Science Foundation, University of Alaska, and the Institute of Arctic Biology, who are all instrumental in this research and allowing me to come along and learn. And then the last slide is question time. I put this just to show off this picture that I took the other day when I stumbled upon a group of penguins enjoying the afternoon. So you'll have to stay tuned into my journals to see the other great pictures I took. So what are your thoughts, questions? I see somebody's asking, do the fish have brains? And they do. In fact, if you look at that very first slide, oh, it's not so visible. Some of the ice fish, the tops of their heads are translucent, and you can see their brains from... okay, so let's see. I see a question here. Yeah, this fish doesn't show it so well. It's mostly the other. It does take a long time to catch fish because we put the trawl. It takes about an hour. It takes 20 minutes to go down to the bottom. 20 minutes along the bottom. Kristen is here if anyone has questions for the scientists. And then 20 minutes to come up. And in that trawl, you might have anywhere from 3 fish to 25 fish. It really depends on what you get. And we are going to eat some of them. I see somebody asking that. I hear they're pretty good. We're going to have a little fish fry with the... I'll let you know how it is.
There was another question here from Betsy Wilkening, and then we'll go to a couple questions live. She asks, doesn't the solubility of oxygen decrease as the temperature of water increases?
Oh, yes. Here, I'm going to put it on speaker.
Can you hear us?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. So the question was the solubility of oxygen. Solubility of oxygen does change in cold water and warm water, which is why we're pumping more oxygen into the warmer tank. Does that answer your question? That's the problem. In the warmer waters, if the waters are warming down here, then that would pose a problem for the ice fish, who will have less availability of oxygen that they can use.
Okay, I'm going to go to a couple live questions here. I know Megan Horse has had her hand up for a while. So, Megan, are you ready to ask your question?
Yes, I am. We had two questions from my fourth grade students. One question from Jacob was, what was the biggest ice fish so far that you've caught? And another one from Mary, what species of jellies have you encountered? We have a big interest in jellies because of the exhibit that's at the Shedd Aquarium right now.
I don't know. I think the biggest, Kristen is here. You want to say hello?
Hi, everybody.
I think the biggest ice fish we caught was probably like 2.5 feet. We had one that was really large.
Yeah, and about 1,200 kilograms.
Yeah. And jellies, I haven't seen a bunch. Mostly I saw jellies when they did sediment samples. I was out with another scientist. We saw some medusa, which were really beautiful. But I couldn't tell you beyond that. I'll have to go to the Shedd Aquarium when I get back, and I'll tell you.
Thanks, Paula.
I think, sure.
And Mark Goldberg, do you have a question you'd like to ask live?
Yeah, I'm Trina Sweeney from Mr. Goldner's class. My question is, what do you do with the fish after you finish researching with it?
Oh, well, after we're researching it, there's not a lot left of it because we take its blood and we look at its heart and its liver and its muscles and all of its different parts. So it sort of helps us understand. It tells us a lot about science. They've done their part for research.
Okay, and we have five questions. Oh, sorry, was there another question from Mark Goldner's class?
what does the iceberg eat?
Oh, the icebergs eat other fish. When we were dissecting them, we found lots of big fish in their stomachs. So they're predatory. Some of the species tend to eat more invertebrates than others. The larger ones, I think, eat the fish, other fish. But if you look at their great big heads, they kind of sit down there on the bottom and grab their prey. Penguins do not eat ice fish that I know of. Do they?
They're probably too deep.
Yeah, they probably live too deep. I thought that was one of the questions. I don't know that any of us know what the population of ice fish in general is. And I don't think there's any sharks down here.
No.
There are no sharks. The ice fish kind of dominate the vertebrate fauna, the vertebrate population, no?
Not the ice fish, no.
The Antarctic fish. Notice on the origin?
Yeah, but that includes both ice fish and red fish.
So the Antarctic fish, red and white-blooded, sort of dominate the vertebrate population.
The fish fauna. So fish. Those are the major, that's a major group of fishes here.
Okay, do we have a live question from Kevin Bolt in your class? Kevin, I see that you're trying to talk, but we cannot hear you, unfortunately.
You were talking about dissection. This is the first dissection we've ever done with a shellfish.
Kevin, I think you're trying to talk.
Can you
hear it out? I didn't hear it. Just maybe if you want to type it in.
Sorry, Kevin, you're a little muffled again. So if you want to type them in, I think that'll work out the best.
I see some other questions here. Which is, some of the fun things we do is we hike up the glacier and go to the other side and find penguins, and we take boat rides to the little islands around here. I got to go and weigh some giant baby petrel chicks, the big birds down here. And it's not light for very long. The sun comes up around 9:30 or 10, and it's dark by about 3:30 here. And I have gone swimming. In fact, I'm going to jump in the water after this. We have a little polar plunge, which sounds horrible, but it's really refreshing. I put some pictures up on the journal. You can see proof of me swimming in the water.
Let's see. We got lots of other questions coming in over the chat here. What was the scariest animal you've encountered so far on your trip?
I think it's when we went over to an island called Humble Island to weigh the petrels, these little baby petrels that hadn't flown away yet. There's also a lot of seals, and fur seals can be kind of mean and ornery. Even though they look cute, they'll charge you. And we were walking over, and we ran into a whole bunch of them that were sitting there, and we had to figure out how we were going to maneuver past them without, a couple of them got up and grunted and fussed, and finally we got around them. So we had to just pretend like we were really big and meaner than they were and wave our hands around so they wouldn't come after us.
And the question from Kevin Bolts' class is, they're currently dissecting starfish and earthworms. I noticed that you dissected some of your fish. So what dissection tips for my students starting their first ever dissection do you have?
I'm going to give that one to Kristen. Which, by the way, there are tons of cool worms in the sediment down here. I've never seen so many different types of worms, but... I might have Kristen, who's a dissection expert, answer that one.
What kind of tips? Well, I guess the most important thing when you're dissecting an animal is to be sure to look really carefully at everything. And, you know, sometimes it's fun to cut out some of the different parts and look at them under a microscope so you can see things closer. It's always good to have a good guide while you're dissecting and sharp tools.
Sharp tools, that's a good one.
And I see William Morrell, your class has a question you'd like to ask Clive?
Just out of curiosity, what time is it in Antarctica?
Oh, well, you know what? Believe it or not, we're 1 hour ahead. We're on Eastern time. If you think vertically, not horizontally, we're not that different.
Are there any other classes that have questions they'd like to ask live? Or just other interesting people that are online? Okay, Megan Horst, go ahead.
Hi, this is Allison from Mokena, Illinois. I have a question. If you somehow injected an ice fish with hemoglobin, what do you think would happen to it?
You know, it would probably kill the fish because just like if we were to get a transfusion of blood that's not ours, our body can't deal with substances that are foreign like that. So when you have a blood transfusion, it has to be your blood type. If you were to just put in plain old hemoglobin, I don't know that it would just be like injecting a foreign substance. I don't know. Scientifically, that'd be something to look into, but it's really a question of their bodies can't make this protein. So it's not like you can inject it and then that protein will replicate.
Hi, this is Danielle Abel from Mokena, Illinois, and I was wondering what's your favorite thing you've pulled up so far?
Wow. That is a hard question, but I think the two things that I really thought were the coolest to look at was the little baby octopus and that crinoid. Do you see that picture? It looked like a big hairy spider. They're very ancient. They've been around for millions of years. But it's that picture in the lower left. That was really amazing. But it's all pretty cool. It's all really cool.
Hey, is there another question? Okay, from Mark Goldner's class.
Hi, this is Courtney from Brooklyn, Massachusetts. I was just wondering, how cold has it ever been down there?
So, you know, it's been pretty warm because we're going into winter here, and it's been, hasn't really gotten below zero since I've been here. The wind, we've had some really windy, cold, snowy days, but when you go further into the continent, it gets way, you know, 100 below zero. It gets really, really cold, but Palmer Station is a lot further north, so it's really beautiful, and there's a lot of wildlife.
Hey, great. Is there another question from William Morrell's class?
Yeah, I know the environment is changing, and the ice is melting, and with the environment getting hotter, there's less oxygen in the water. Do you think they might adapt to the environment or die out?
Well, that's one of the things we're looking at, to see what might happen. There's certainly changes in wildlife populations, like that article I was talking about in the New York Times with the penguin population. The species are changing in terms of who's more
prevalent and who's less prevalent. There's changes in the krill and the smaller organisms, the invertebrates. Even here, the glacier, if you look at, I wish I had the date, one of my journals, I have a picture of where the glacier that's behind the Palmer Station was in 1965 and where it is now. And it's scary to see how much it's receded. And in fact, they discovered an island that they didn't know existed, which was named after some scientists, one of whom is sitting right here, Amsler Island.
Okay, and is there another question live from Megan Horse's class?
This is Amanda Finn from Illinois, Mokina, Illinois. My opinion of my favorite animal, so I'd like to ask you, what is the most popular penguin you see?
Oh, you know what? I have seen almost exclusively the Gentoos. I don't think I've seen any Adelie or Emperor penguins. But they're cute. They have orange bills. They're easy to spot.
Is it what you have in the picture on the slide?
Yeah, that's a Gentoo. And there are no polar bears.